are listening to The History of Religions and Their Gods, hosted by me, the skeptical ghost heathen. Oh, you're going to need a copy of L. Ron Hubbard's Dianetics and a toothbrush for this one, baby. Let's go. Hello, heathens, and welcome back to the show. Well, guess what? Today's January 20th, 2023. And it's awesome, just 10 days away until my birthday. Now, I'm sure if you're thinking about getting me something nice, well, there's always the gift that keeps on giving. That would be share the love. Share this episode. Put it on your social media. Don't be afraid. But if you're still listening to me, if you're still hearing my voice, even though it's a little scratchy right now because I think I got a cold, but this is episode 2 of season 6. And then we're going to pick up where we left off on New Year's Day when I released episode 1, Mark's Homeric Epic and the Gospel of Odysseus, which is basically a study of Dennis MacDonald's book, The Homeric Epics and the Gospel of Mark. Now at this point, fellas and ladies, I would like to go through the book and discuss his findings as they relate to the author for Mark, borrowing the literary works of Homer's Odyssey, as well as the Iliad, to handcraft narratives for his Jesus in comparison to Homer's Odysseus, and how Jesus can outperform him and his antiquated Greek values, whether it's theological, political, or sociological. Now, as we learned before, this author does the same exact thing for the Jews, who chose war over peace, by creating parallels through the Greek Septuagint, the Old Testament in Greek, to demonstrate that Jesus outperforms the old Jewish prophets, specifically Elisha, Elijah, and Moses, from being able to make more food, to performing better miracles, to performing way better water tricks. Now please note, as we go through this book, I'm not going to be reading it verbatim. That's boring. Instead, I'm going to be delivering the information to you freely and openly, just like I am now, as in the first person from here on out. So if you guys are ready, grab those L. Ron Hubbard Dianetics, grab your toothbrush, and put on your helmets and strap your seatbelt, and let's do this thing. Let's go. I've been studying the gospel according to Mark for about a good 5 years now as an atheist, trying to make sense of all the strange and bizarre oddities that I found all throughout it, that for the dozen of times that I read it as a theist, I just simply glazed over those problems. But immediately after studying the Jewish Wars by Josephus, I too started finding some noticeable parallels between the two bodies of work, that of Mark and Josephus. And I'm not talking like Atwell's Roman conspiracy or anything alike, but rather where this author wanted to demonstrate that his Jesus was replacing the old covenant between God and the Jews. And it became alarmingly clear that this author was criticizing the Jews who were, in Paul's own words, misinterpreting Scripture, thinking that God wanted them to bear arms, enter into war with the largest and most powerful army to the west, the Roman Empire. So to Mark, his Jesus was the New Testament, the new covenant with God, and not those who chose to follow false prophets instead, being the leaders of the rebellion who would not be saved in the next life. And the only way to salvation, according to this author, was through his Jesus, who died for the sins of all the Jews. Oh, metaphorically, of course. Now, the difference between Mark and Paul is that Paul never once mentioned a historical crucifixion by the Romans, set up by the Jewish elite, or any other historicizing elements that we find in the Markan Gospel, such as family, or even disciples for that matter. Because none of that exists until Mark decades later. But it most certainly appears that to Paul, he is blaming Satan and his sky demons for the murder of Jesus Christ. As he assumes in Romans 13, where it was the rulers of our age that killed Jesus. Where Christians want to say that means Pontius Pilate. But the giveaway here is the Greek that he uses, archons, which he only uses, or anyone only uses, for rulers such as Zeus, or Satan in a celestial sense, not an earthbound sense. While Mark, who seems absolutely obsessed with the destruction of the temple and a million dead Jews, blames the Jewish elite and Jews in general as a wicked generation for the murder of his Jesus versus Paul's celestial Satan. Because in Paul's world, Jesus was fighting Satan in the realms of heaven. This here creates a never-ending theme of Christians demonizing the Jews for generations to come, to the point of their attempted extermination and continued anti-Semitism even found today. Just like in the opening chapters of Mark, after Jesus is baptized in the River Jordan, he goes off to hang out in the wild, only to be tempted by Satan there three times. Just like, ironically, the Israelites did the Yahweh in the Exodus narrative. So here once again, this author has made a cognizant literary switch. A comparison to the Jews tempting God from the Septuagint to the Jews now being Satan tempting Jesus in the wilderness. And of course, Mark's Jesus passes the test, unlike the Israelites did. See what he does there? This author also used the events of the Jewish wars and the Greek Septuagint to slam and criticize the Jews who chose war over peace. This topic has made it abundantly clear that this author was a Roman sympathizer, and more than likely, living in Rome. But now, after reading Homer's Odyssey, as well as the Iliad, after what I had discovered in the wars of the Jews, well, I started wondering if there were connections there as well, doing the same exact thing that Mark did to the Septuagint and the events during the Jewish wars and Judean affairs. And this became clear after doing some deep research on the apocryphal book called the Acts of Andrew, which is dated somewhere around the same time as Luke, Acts, and perhaps the Gospel of John, all early to mid-second century works. But when reading this Acts on the surface, well, it reads like any other Christian apocrypha, where the apostle goes out and about, traveling around, preaching about his Jesus, even exorcising some demons, perhaps healing the sick, opposing the wicked, often the lovesick, political authorities, and in the end, offer his life to Jesus in martyrdom. But just like Mark, when read at a deeper level, it appears that the Acts of Andrew is completely allegory. It appears as if the author for Andrew peppered his narrative with several markers and clues that would tell his readers or hearers that the character of his book all play roles that were derived from classical Greek literature. In fact, Andrew himself appropriates the virtues of Greek notables, such as Hercules, Achilles, Hector, Socrates, and especially that of Odysseus. Whereas most other characters in his book represent the vices of Greek gods and heroes. Basically, this acts as a transvaluative hypertext of several of the most popular literary works from Greek antiquity, and above all, the Odyssey and the Iliad. So what does that mean exactly? Well, it means this book, it screams to the reader to find clues that criticizes the values of one while demonstrating that the values are superior of another by making obvious connections to one of the characters from other literature. Now, for example, I once bought my son a book entitled Sleeping Ugly, which would be a transvaluative hypertext of Sleeping Beauty, right? A transvaluative of the fairy tale by replacing its patriarchy with a more feminist perspective. In fact, many scholars of Christian literature have observed a similar phenomenon in classical authors, creating imitations of pagan models that contrast the context of the originals with those of the later Christian copies, including the Gospels and the Bible on your nightstands right now. But let's talk about this Acts of Andrews for a minute and what this author does. Now, just like what we found in Mark, this guy replaces all the violence, the greed, and the lust, as well as the physical imperfections of the Greek gods and heroes, with the virtues of idealized Christians. For example, Zeus, he stops chasing women. And Ares abandons his weapons. Aphrodite and Helen and breast continence. Or Oedipus rejects sex with his mother. And Hercules is no longer crazed. However, this author for Andrew does curse Hephaestus for his lameness, or Tarsius of his blindness, and Philoctetes of his festering wound. And then the apostle in the story of Andrew, who is, of course, he's a fisherman, right? And whose name literally means in Greek manliness, dies at the edge of the sea, tied to his cross. Just like Odysseus was tied to the mast of his ship. It seems that every episode in the Acts of Andrew corresponds one way or another to the scenes found in Greek mythology. Except for, of course, those scenes that rely on Plato's depiction of Socrates. Now, the scholars who are working on the thesis of Homer and Mark unanimously never saw the connection before. After all, those who studied the role of the epic in the early church observed that no Christian author ever referred to Homer or even quoted from his epics prior to Justin Martyr, who lived in the second century, and have concluded from the silence that in no way did Homer influence any of the Gospels. But when later Christians mention the Bard, which is a poet who cites the epics, they did so in order to lambast his gods for their adulteries, murders, and their thefts. But in recent Markan studies, scholars have begun to notice that there are indeed echoes of the Odyssey, with parallels made between Jesus and Odysseus, and then again between Jesus' disciples and Odysseus' crew, then between the Jewish authorities and Penelope's suitors. And then between the entire episodes in the two works, the Odyssey and the Iliad. Now, both epics and the Gospel of Mark demonstrated a fascination with sea travel, a suffering hero, secrecy, lessons taught in parables, and the victories of their heroes over their arrogant and murderous foes. Scholars can now see, after making the discovery in the Acts of Andrew, that Mark, our first gospel author, used the Odyssey as his primary literary inspiration, but also imitated books 22 and 24 of the Iliad for narrating Jesus' death and burial. Sometimes the similarities obtain even at the level of the word choice and minor plot elements. Furthermore, have come to the conclusion, like all other mythical tales, this author for Mark, whoever he was, wanted his readers to detect his transvaluation of Homer's epics. In some cases, blatant. And others, buried enough, just deep enough, that you had to dig a little bit in order to uncover it. Now, I think it's important to understand that when one reads Mark as a Homeric hypertext, texts that scream out clues of another story altogether, it now permits a reliable solution to their perplexing problems of the kind of book that this guy from Mark was intending to write to his audience. Earlier scholarship, they viewed Mark as a passive transcriber of tradition, and his gospel as a product of oral traditional memories of Jesus. But till now, subsequent studies have demonstrated over and over and over again Mark's artful and thoughtful redaction of traditions to a coherent literary work, pulling from the great epics. They were also in circulation during his time, and use of written sources such as the seven Pauline epistles that were available decades earlier, and a sophisticated development of characterizations and plot. We can see that Mark is a well-handcrafted, anti-Homeric novel, and not a biography of some demigod miracle worker. In fact, the author who wrote Mark must have used one or more literary models to craft his work. And the quest for finding these models have focused on identifying texts that were closest to his genre, which is the elusive holy grail of gospel studies. Scholars have wandered through ancient literature searching for similarities, and they have returned with several suggestions, such as Jewish martyrologies, Plato's Death of Socrates and Greek tragedies, erotology, some folk literature, historical novels, and even biographies. Now, the most popular solution maintains that Mark intended to write a biography of sorts, but was bothered by the unreliable legendary traditions that were available to him at the time. So he created his own narrative. However, guys, in this series, I'm going to argue that the key to Mark's composition has less to do with genre than its imitation of specific texts of a different genre altogether, in order to exploit and to criticize Roman imperialism, radical Judaism, through a comparative roles of Jesus to Odysseus. Mark wrote a prose epic modeled largely after the Odyssey and the Iliad, but based on the characters from Paul's letters, and more than likely, written for Paul's congregations decades after his death, when the religion began to die or fade out, especially after the destruction of the Jewish nation and its people in 70. As a matter of fact, Mark's Jesus shares a lot with Homer's Hector, and even more so with Odysseus, because Odysseus and Jesus both sail the seas with associates who are far more inferior to them, who weaken whenever confronted with any sort of suffering or challenge at all. But both heroes return to home only to find it infested with murderous rivals that devour the houses of widows. Also, both need to oppose supernatural foes, visit dead heroes, and prophesize their own return, and in the third person. Which is weird, right? And in each story, a wise woman anoints each central character, and both eat last suppers with their comrades before having to go straight to hell, from which they both return, of course, alive. It gets way better than that. That's just a teaser. Because in both works, one finds gods stilling storms and walking on water and feeding thousands at the shore with monsters hiding in caves. Mark's dependence on the Odyssey further suggests elegant solutions to some of the most enigmatic and disputed aspects of this gospel, such as the depiction of the disciples as being stupid, lazy, inept, greedy, cowardly, and even treacherous. Even its interest in the sea, meals, and secrecy, and even its mysterious reference to the unnamed young man who fled naked at Jesus' arrest. However, this author for Mark did not steal from the epics, I mind you. He instead transvalued them simply by making Jesus more virtuous and more powerful than Homer's Odysseus, as well as Hector. And just like Hector in the Iliad, Jesus too must die at the end of the book. His corpse is rescued from the executioner, and he is mourned by exactly three women. But unlike Hector, Jesus is presumably raised from the dead, but to serve a couple of other reasons that we'll talk about later. But one to fulfill the answer to his audience why Jesus didn't come during the fall of the temple, and that he will come only when God wants him to. And two, to demonstrate that while Hector dies, Jesus dies, but returns, because he's better than Hector, and he's more powerful than Hector. Making the slam in criticizing Homer's Bible. Now, one thing is for sure, is that this author was definitely selling the story to the Jews and Gentiles of Paul's communities because of how he ends the book in 16:8, where the two women run frightened from the empty tomb when Jesus is missing, and the naked boy from the arrest waits inside. Because the women told no one and ran frightened. This is why Paul's communities never heard of any of these odd and ridiculous stories about Jesus before. Now, I'm quite certain that this author probably had to cut his literary teeth on his epic, which also explains a major incongruity in his composition. Despite its rustic and at times barbaric Greek, the gospel's literary achievement is absolutely brilliant. And most of this brilliance is because of the Homeric redaction. Now, because of Homer's unrivaled authority in ancient education, well, such imitations were actually quite common among the students of the first century, including Mark. In fact, students learned their ABCs, if you would, by identifying them in epic poetry. And only after demonstrating capability to their teachers with the Iliad and the Odyssey were they permitted to move on and advance to other books. So scholars were exposed to Homer for a long, long time, guys. Although it would be hyperbolic to call the epics a Bible for the Greeks, however, they did function as encyclopedias of religion, as well as history, and especially culture and ethics. Even Plato, for example, no friend of Homer, mind you, had to admit, this poet educated all of Greece. We also have one extant catalog of manuscripts that were used in school from Greco-Roman Egypt that lists out 604 works of Homer, not including scholia or anthologies or commentaries. And in a distant second place is Demosthenes with 83. Euripides with 77, Hesiod with 72, and Plato with just 42. So it's demonstrably true that students of the ancient world, such as the author for Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John, were all well-versed in the epics and how those epics were facilitated. In other words, the reader of Mark's Gospels knew exactly what he was doing when he was writing in myth. Now, literary students in the ancient world, in ancient schools, well, they all learned how to write, even at the most basic level, largely through what is called mimesis, or its Latin equivalent, imitatio. There's a Quintilian quote here that reads like this. One might say that from his entry into the home of the schoolmaster, the good students of antiquity was taken into a mechanism that would surely make him an author trained to the rules of mimesis. Quintilian also wrote to another teacher of rhetoric as well. There can be no doubt that in the art, no small portion of our task lies in imitatio. Since, although invention came first and it is all important, it is expedient to follow whatever has been invented with success. Now, it's important to realize something here. The favorite target for imitation, or imitatio, was the Homeric epics, especially for writing of poetry, as in the Argonautica by Apollonius of Rhodes, or the Aeneid by Virgil, or the Posamerica by Quintus Smyrnaeus, and the Dionysiaca by Nonnos of Panopolis. Moreover, even Jewish poets and authors, they love to imitate Homer, such as the surviving fragments that we have of On the Jews by Theodotus, as well as On Jerusalem by Philoepicus, both of whom narrated Jewish themes in dactylic hexameters. This was also known as heroic hexameter, or the meter of epic. And it's a form of meter or rhythmic scheme that was frequently used in ancient Greek, as well as Latin poetry. The scheme of the hexameter is usually as follows. Writing where the writer would write a long dash for a long syllable, a U for a short syllable, and a UU for a position that may be a long or two shorts, as an example. And there's an obscure medieval note that states that a certain Sosates, that was the Jewish Homer, flourished there in Alexandria between 142 and 51 BCE. Originally, it appeared that no Christian poet ever imitated the Homeric meter before the late 3rd century, because the date assigned to a peculiar text among the Bodmer papyri, which is basically a group of 22 papyri discovered in Egypt in 1952. Sure seems like we found a lot of shit right around there. But they named it basically after a guy named Martin Bodmer, who actually purchased them, probably at a garage sale. But the papyri contained segments of the Old as well as the New Testament, some early Christian literature, as well as Homer and Menander. Now, the oldest item, P66, dates to 200 CE, the Visions of Dorotheus. Well, it consists of 343 lines of dactylic hexameters and narrates the author's vision of events in heaven in transparent dependence of the Iliad. That's right, Homer's Iliad. The author identifies himself as the son of Quintus the poet, probably Quintus Marinaeus, who was the author of Posthumerica, which was an epic poem that was designed to fill the gaps between the Iliad and the Odyssey. Now, although the vision of Dorotheus, it imitates the Iliad, it also completely rejects and even omits anything and everything violent outright, which would be a conscious Christian transvaluation of Greek ethics. You guys get that? And then many later Christian poets would go on to express their religious views by overtly imitating Homer's works, including some famous Christian authors, Apollinarius of Laodicea, or Gregory of Nazianzus, Arnanos, and Empress Eudoxia. That was actually Gregory of Nazianzus. Excuse me. Now, this is really of no surprise, because imitations of Homer were actually very much quite common in prose. In fact, students during the gospel writer's time, especially Mark, was taught and learned to imitate literature across multiple genres, especially by paraphrasing epics in two works of prose. And we can see an abundance of examples of this type of thing appearing in extant scholar writing exercises, including at least one by a Christian. Now, Quintilian supposed that his readers would have taken this type of activity for granted. And here's a quote. "I think we shall all agree that this paraphrasing is especially valuable with regards to poetry. Indeed, it is said that the paraphrase of poetry into prose was the sole form of exercise by the rhetor Sulpicius." Additionally, the literateur Philodemus asked, and here's a quote, "Who would claim that writing of prose is not reliant on the Homeric poems?" End quote. Authors of prose imitated the Odyssey more frequently than any other book in the ancient world. It was supplemented, it was parodied, even burlesqued, dramatized, prosified, and transformed to serve an array of un-Homeric values in one way or another. In fact, there are several scenes of the epics that actually became normal set pieces in literary composition. For example, the never-ending shipwreck stories. The Bible is full of them. The goddess Circe, the sirens, the Nikea, who visited the underworld, Polyphemus, and the Phaeaces. Now, particularly relevant to the New Testament is the influence that the Odyssey utilized on the historical novel, Mark's epic of the Hellenistic period, fulfilling the functions of an epic in a new age and new updated current time, while assuming some of its techniques. We could see evidence of the Odyssean influence in novels by Chariton, Longus, Antonius Diogenes, Philostratus, Achilles Tatius, Heliodorus, and especially Petronius, Lucian, and Apuleius, as well as the anonymous story of the Apollonius king of Tyre. Now, there were no limits obtained to what type of features of the hypotext an author might imitate and use for their works. Whether it was genre, use of characters, type scenes, plot scenes, poetic convention, and distinctive motifs. In fact, imitative reliance on the classical tradition did not stifle or constrain originality, according to the ancient point of view. Because the type of imitation, it evolved and in no sense was plagiaristic, and only sporadically was close to verbal imitation ever employed in the story. Now, I know for a fact that imitations of Homer, especially the Odyssey, also appear in many Jewish prose and poetry. In fact, the author who wrote the Book of Tobit, well, he borrowed extensively from the great epic. Although he most certainly did not expect his Aramaic readers to suspect that he used this Greek model to craft a story. Although even in some of the writings from Josephus, we see display of the possible imitations of Homer there as well. And in many cases, it appears that he may have even have wanted his readers to detect and even appreciate his free adaptions in order to make a point, whether it was political or theological. Now, texts that discuss rhetorical imitations frequently mention the practice of occulting or disguising one's reliance on a model for their story based on an epic. But for obsequious imitations, that could lead to charges of boorish pedantry and even plagiarism. So these disguises, well, they included altering the vocabulary a little bit, varying or changing up the order, changing the length as well as the structure of the sentence, improving and even updating the content, and generating a series of formal transformations from the original works of Homer. However, students usually only imitated a single work, where the professional, like our guy here for Mark, borrowed and imitated from many works, just like the painter Zeuxis, who, when commissioned to paint a portrait of Helen, well, he assembled the most beautiful girls of the city, and from there combined their features and composed what he thought was the most perfect image of her. Now, this time of eclecticism also disguised reliance on the primary target of imitation, such as Homer. Now, I'll give you an example here, because skilled authors like Mark's author were like bees that took the best nectar from many different blossoms in order to produce the best textual honey. Now, according to Seneca the Younger, such Appian authors should blend those several flavors into one delicious compound that, even though it betrays its origins, yet nevertheless is clearly a different thing from what it whence it came. Now, one achieves the height of imitation, however, when he says this, when the true copy stamps its own from upon all the features in which it has drawn from that we may call the original. So that, in quotation, it is impossible for it to be seen who is being imitated. Seneca the Younger, born 4 BCE, died 65 AD, a decade before Mark composed his Homeric epic of his own. Now, the most sophisticated form of literary imitation, however, was emulato, which literally means rivalry. These emulations announce, albeit quite subtly, but their reliance on their model, and at the same time attempt to speak even better. So to the observant reader who gets it and who's looking for it, who notices the strategically placed myth markers, we'll compare the model, or the hypotext, with the hypertext, and then perhaps judge the imitation as superior to the original. Whether in literary expression, or philosophical acuity, or perhaps even religious power. But many ancient literary imitations of the Homeric epics all fall into this category of types. Whether the emulations are parodies, like the Batrachum Myomachia, which literally means the Battle of the Frogs and Mice, which is a comic epic, or a parody of Homer's Iliad or Margites, which is a comic mock epic ascribed to Homer, or Latin philosophical belletristics, like the Aeneid. And the success of these transvaluations required the reader to detect the presence of the hypotext, the illuminating markers to the myth that would catch the reader's attention, catch their eye, force them to look for more clues to figure out, well, what was the original? What's different between the two stories? Because that is the intention of the myth. And to this end, the new author supplied the hypertextual clues, if that makes sense. And there are some favorite flags for hypertextuality in prose, and it's usually found in signifying names, such as Petronius expected his readers to make those proper connections or associations when they confronted his characters, such as Menelaus, Agamemnon, and Circe, because his characters frequently parodied Homer's, contrasting epic nobility against the flabby hedonism of contemporary Romans. Now in this series, and I guess right now we're officially chapter 2, we're going to look closely at Mark's imitations of Homeric epics, both occult and disclose as well as simultaneously conceal and reveal hidden clues for his readers of the first century to find. The earliest evangelist to write, decades after Paul, mind you, disguised this dependence on Homer by writing in prose, altering Homeric vocabulary, rearranging episodes, moving time around, and also borrowing heavily from Jewish scripture and literature as well, just like Seneca's bee. He blended together several flavors into one delicious compound that Christians today eagerly devour like a starving lion. But the interesting thing about this author for Mark, he was no slave to his models. Rather, he thoroughly and cleverly and strategically emulated these stories to depict his Jesus, or Paul's Jesus, I suppose, as more compassionate, more powerful, and stronger than the heroes of the Greek epics, as well as the Jewish prophets, such as Elisha and Elijah, but especially the leaders of the Jewish-Roman revolt, John Gischala, Simon Bar Gioras, and Eleazar ben Ananias. You remember the temple captain that cut the Romans off from tribute. Now, this author aims much of his criticism at these guys, not to mention Agrippa II, all portrayed by characters in the Old Testament, the Odyssey, Iliad, and Josephus's Jewish Wars. Mark's hero in his epic must be more noble and even more injured than Odysseus in Homer's tale. Though Jesus's death resembles Hector's death in the Iliad, Jesus gets to return from the dead, leaving an empty tomb behind, whereas Hector's body is simply burned up into smoke. Nearly every episode, with parallels in the epics, all display theological rivalry between Homer's view and the view of Mark's Christians of the late first century. Not to mention, there was still an abundance of healing hearts and stricken fear in the Jews and Christians after the war in 73. You have to imagine that after what seemed to be the wrath of God on the holiest city in the known world, people needed a change. They definitely needed some comfort, a way to avoid the persecution and continued talks of war as seen in Mark 13. You have just concluded chapter 2 of Mark's Homeric epic and the Gospel of Odysseus. And this, my friends, has been a Skeptical Ghost Heathen production.